What larger gesture would we see about to complete itself in our lives? What do we need to embrace? The walls of our soul begin to crumble, and the first glimmerings of transformation, of teshuvah, begin to seep in. We turn and stop looking beyond ourselves. We stop defending ourselves. We stop blaming bad luck and circumstances and other people for our difficulties. We turn in and let the walls fall. Our suffering, the unresolved element of our lives, is also from God. It is the instrument by which we are carried back to God, not something to be defended against, but rather to be embraced. And this embrace begins here on Tisha B'Av, 7 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, so that by the 10 days of Teshuvah we are ready for transformation. We can enter the present moment of our lives and consciously alter that moment. We can end our exile. We can step outside our walls and feel the full force of the great tidal pulls on our body and our soul, sun and moon, inhale and exhale, life and death, the walls building up and the walls crumbling down again. Chapter 4. The horn blew, and I began to wake up. Elul. Suddenly, you are awakened by a strange noise, a noise that fills the full field of your consciousness and then splits into several jagged strands, shattering that field, shaking you awake. The ram's horn, the shofar, the same instrument that will sound 100 times on Rosh Hashanah, the same sound that filled the world when the Torah was spoken into being on Mount Sinai, is being blown to call you to wakefulness. You awake to confusion. Where are you? Who are you? Then you remember. In exactly 1 month, 1 revolution of the moon, you will stand before God. What will God see on that day? What will you see? This encounter can carry you significantly closer to the truth of your life. Standing in the light of God, you can see a great deal more than you ordinarily might, but only to the degree that you are already awake, only in proportion to the time and energy you have devoted to preparing for this encounter. So it is that the Mate Moshe proclaimed, "Every person must prepare himself for 30 days beforehand with repentance and prayer and charity, for the day when he will appear in judgment before God on Rosh Hashanah. Therefore let every person scrutinize their actions with a view to mending them. Let them exclude themselves for 1 hour every day and examine themselves." And Rabbi Chaim David Azulai declared, "During Elul, the month before Rosh Hashanah, one should devote less time to study and more time to fixed periods of introspection and self-evaluation." And the Kav HaYashar recorded that many men in his time observed silence between the advent of Elul and Rosh Hashanah to effect the purification of their souls. The horn blows to usher in Elul, and it is blown every morning of the month of Elul as well, lest we forget and slip back, lest we surrender to the entropic pull of mindlessness. The Torah also stands ready to help keep us awake. As we move through the month of Elul, we also move through the book of Deuteronomy, and each of the weekly Torah readings, Re'eh, Shoftim, Netzavim, Ki Tetzeh, whispers to us, "Wake up. Wake up." Each of these readings offers a subtle rhyme to the process of awakening to which the month of Elul has called us. Parshat Re'eh. Look, I put before you this day a blessing and a curse. So begins Parshat Re'eh, the weekly Torah portion we read as the month of Elul begins. Look, pay attention to your life. Every moment in it is profoundly mixed. Every moment contains a blessing and a curse. Everything depends on our seeing our lives with clear eyes, seeing the potential blessing in each moment as well as the potential curse, choosing the former, forswearing the latter. Parshat Re'eh begins with a concretization of this spiritual reality, a ritual that renders this invisible reality visible. As the Israelites crossed the Jordan River to enter the Promised Land, they staged a dramatic pageant. They wrote the Word of God on 12 great stones and placed the stones on the peak of Mount Gerizim. Half of the nation of Israel stood on the slopes of Mount Gerizim and the other half stood on the slopes of Mount Ebal across the valley. Standing in the valley between the two mountains, the priestly tribe, the Levites, faced Mount Gerizim and intoned a series of blessings, and all the people said, Amen. Then the Levites faced the slopes of Mount Ebal and intoned a series of curses, and all the people said, Amen, again. The message of this ritual was clear. The will of God is present every moment. Every moment contains the capacity for good and evil, life and death, a blessing and a curse, and everything depends on our choice. Look, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that I have set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. Therefore, choose life so that you may live, Moses repeats in the ringing peroration to the book of Deuteronomy. We learn a number of things from this. We learn that this business of choosing good over evil, life over death, is precisely a matter of life and death. Our lives quite literally depend on it. And we learn that it is a matter of consciousness also. We have to come to see our life very clearly, clearly enough so that we can discern the will of God in it, so that we can tell the difference between the blessings and the curses, so that these things are arrayed before us as clearly as mountains, as we intone their names from the valley in between, that sliver of eternity on which we stand and that we call the present moment. This is why we are advised to spend the month of Elul in the regular practice of introspection, self-examination, and silence. We no longer perform the great pageant of the blessings and the curses, Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. But this pageant was a ritual, and the inner process that this ritual was trying to express in visual form persists. Today, we have our own ritualization of it, the days of awe, the high holy days, the time when it is made equally clear to us that everything depends upon our own moral and spiritual choices. And although we no longer have the two great mountains to help us see this choice in concrete form, we do have the month of Elul, a time to gaze upon the inner mountains, to devote serious attention to bringing our lives into focus, a time to clarify the distinction between the will of God and our own willfulness, to identify that in us which yearns for life and that which clings to death, that which seeks good and that which is fatally attracted to the perverse, to find out who we are and where we are going. All the rabbis who comment on this period make it clear that we must do these things during the month of Elul. We must set aside time each day of Elul to look at ourselves, to engage in self-evaluation and self-judgment, to engage in cheshbon ha-nefesh, literally a spiritual accounting. But we get very little in the way of practical advice as to how we might do this. So allow me to make some suggestions. Prayer. The Hebrew word for prayer is tefillah. The infinitive form of this verb is hitpalel, to pray, a reflexive form denoting action that one performs on oneself. Many scholars believe that the root of this word comes from a Ugaritic verb for judgment, and that the reflexive verb, hitpalel, originally must have meant to judge oneself. This is not the usual way we think of prayer. Ordinarily, we think we should pray to ask for things or to bend God's will to our own. But it is no secret to those who pray regularly and with conviction that one of the deepest potentials of prayer is that it can be a way we come to know ourselves. This is true in at least two ways. First, when we pray, We stand before God. We invoke God's presence. We see ourselves through God's unblinking gaze. From this point of view, it becomes rather more difficult to engage in the kind of self-deception and highly selective interpretation of data we usually employ to make assessments of ourselves. God isn't as easy to deceive as we are. God has the annoying tendency of taking everything into account, and not just the aspects of our experience that make us look good or bad, if that's what we're up to. I have either meditated or prayed every day for the better part of the last 30 years. There have been a few occasions during this time when I've done something I knew to be wrong at the time that I did it. These times, for most of us, are rather rare. Most of the time, the negative, destructive things we do are done unconsciously. The remedy for this, of course, is simply to become more conscious, more aware. But what about those rare times when consciousness is not the problem? What about the times when we are perfectly conscious to begin with, when we say to ourselves, I know this is wrong, I know this is going to be hurtful and destructive both to myself and to others, but damn it, I'm going to do it anyway. After performing such a deed, it is possible to go through much of one's life in denial or to construct elaborate justifications for why you did it. But it is impossible to employ such strategies while standing before God. Then, the naked truth of what we have done cannot be denied, and all our justifications crumble to dust. Standing before God, we see ourselves whether we want to or not. It is also the case that there is something about the mechanics of prayer that causes us to know ourselves. Like all spiritual activities, Jewish communal prayer has a point of focus. In this case, the words of the prayer book. We try to concentrate on these words, but inevitably our mind wanders and we lose our focus. When we realize that this has happened, we bring our focus back to the words of the prayer book, and as we do, we catch a glimpse of what it is that has carried us away. This is an important thing to see. The thoughts that carry our attention away are never insignificant thoughts, and they never arise at random. We lose our focus precisely because these thoughts need our attention and we refuse to give it to them. This is why they keep sneaking up on our attention and stealing it away. This is how it is that we come to know ourselves as we settle deeply into the act of prayer. Most likely we are utterly unaware of all this. After all, it operates well below the level of consciousness. Nevertheless, sitting there with the prayer book in our lap, we begin to become aware of the things we have been trying to avoid. We begin to see things from which we have been averting our gaze. Unconscious material begins to make its way toward the surface of our consciousness. So, during the month of Elul, one of the times we can use to examine ourselves, to engage in self-assessment and self-judgment, is the time spent in communal prayer. We can either devote more time to this activity, or if we already pray quite regularly, now we can do so with a more focused intention to have our praying become tefillah in the original sense, an act of self-judgment, an opportunity to see ourselves more clearly. Meditation also presents us with this opportunity, although much has been written in recent years about the various aspects of Jewish spiritual activity that resemble meditation. Nowhere is this similarity more apparent than in the month of Elul, when we are bidden to set aside time each day to look inward, to take account of ourselves spiritually. Sitting each day at a specified time during the month of Elul, we may focus on our breath and our body, holding our body at the balance point between tension and relaxation, watching the breath as it enters and leaves the body just below the navel, letting the belly fill up with breath, and then letting the breath go out. As we saturate these most fundamental aspects of our reality with awareness, we find that we are inhabiting ourselves in a deeper way than we usually do. And gradually, this sense spreads to our heart, and our mind, and our soul. And we find that we are also inhabiting our feelings, our thoughts, and our spirit more deeply. That we are filling these things with more consciousness than we usually do, that we are feeling them more immediately, more concretely, more viscerally. In short, that we are coming to inhabit the present tense reality of who we are, coming to see our real moral and spiritual position and what is required of us next. Exactly the same phenomena we described in relation to prayer arise when we meditate, that moment of insight when we bear witness to the thoughts that have carried our awareness away, that moment when we come to know precisely what these thoughts are, precisely what it is that we aren't looking at, and so keep sneaking up on us and grabbing our attention. In fact, it is just this process that the physiologist Herbert Benson identifies as the fundamental gesture of meditation, the gesture he calls the relaxation response. According to Benson, all the brain wave changes and psycho-spiritual effects we have come to associate with meditation are set off precisely at the moment when we come to realize that our mind has been carried away from the object of our concentration, and we resolve to gently bring it back. When we were speaking of prayer, it was the words of the prayer book that we were trying to focus on. Here in meditation, it might be the breath, and it might be the body. It might be a mantra, and it might be a visualization, but in all these cases, the result is the same. We come to see ourselves more clearly. We come to see the things we either will not or cannot see. And meditation helps us see something else as well. It helps us see that we are something larger than ourselves. This is an essential aspect of Rosh Hashanah, seeing ourselves as not just a discrete ego, but as part of a great flow of being. The very first thing the Talmud has to say about Rosh Hashanah is this: On Rosh Hashanah, all the inhabitants of the earth stand before God, as it says in the 33rd Psalm, God fashions their hearts as one and discerns all their actions together. When we sit in meditation with other people, breathing the same air, hearing the same sounds, thinking thoughts in the same rhythms and patterns, we experience our connection to each other in a very immediate way. This connection is not merely an idea, it is our heartfelt, visceral reality. This is an important part of the process of seeing ourselves. Meditation helps us inhabit ourselves more deeply, and it constantly throws us up against the very things about ourselves we are trying not to see. But it carries the process of insight one step further. It helps us to see that we are not merely our individual selves, but part of something much more vast as well. Focus on one thing. It may not be realistic to expect a significant number of people to suddenly begin showing up at prayer minyans or meditation groups during the month of Elul. Some of us are simply not made to engage in these activities, not in Elul, not ever. Many will never get over finding the daily prayer service tedious and opaque. Many others will always either be frightened to death or bored to tears by the prospect of meditation and the blank wall of self it keeps throwing us up against so relentlessly. So I am pleased to inform you that it is perfectly possible to fulfill the ancient imperative to begin becoming more self-aware during this time without doing these things. Let me recommend a simpler method, and you won't even have to set aside a special time to practice this. You have set aside the time already. Just choose one simple and fundamental aspect of your life and commit yourself to being totally conscious and honest about it for the 30 days of Elul. A world in a grain of sand, as the poet William Blake reminded us. Everything we do is an expression of the entire truth of our lives. It doesn't really make any difference what it is that we choose to focus on, but it ought to be something pretty basic. Something like eating, or sex, or money, if for no other reason than that these concerns are likely to arise quite frequently in our lives, and to give us a lot of grist for the mill. Parshat Re'eh has some interesting things to say about eating, for example, that might be helpful in this regard. After the ancient Israelites offered a sacrifice, they were bidden to eat it, but only all that your soul desires. This is a strange phrase, is it not? Only all that your soul desires. What could it mean? All that your soul desires seems to suggest an unlimited condition. What then is the force of the limiting only in this sentence? I think what the Torah is saying here is that we should only eat until we are satiated. You shall eat, and you shall reach the point of satiety, and then you shall bless the Lord your God. This familiar imperative is also found in the Parshat Re'eh, and it expresses the same thing. We should eat to the point of satiety, but not beyond that point. We should eat only what our soul desires, only what our body requires, and not what our unconscious desires bid us to eat. I think it's a very rare thing that we eat out of hunger these days, and it is even rarer that we stop eating when our hunger is slaked. At a rabbinical retreat once, a man gave me a stress-measuring device called a biodot. The biodot was a tiny piece of paper treated with a chemical that responded to changes in temperature by changing color. The idea was that when we were under stress, our fight-or-flight instinct rushed all the blood to the extremities of the body, where it would be needed. All this blood rushing to our hands raised the temperature there. So when we were under stress, the biodot registered this change in temperature by turning black. In happier, more relaxed states, the blood settled back into the heart and the inner organs, leaving the hands much cooler. At such times, the biodot turned green, and then finally, when we were in the deepest state of relaxation, a radiant cerulean blue. Back from the retreat, I watched the biodot changing color as I went about my daily life for several weeks. I noticed, for example, that as soon as I walked into my synagogue, the dot turned a livid, menacing black. It made no difference what I did there. I could pray, I could meditate for hours, but just being in the building threw me into a deep state of stress. Conversely, there were activities that were just as dependable for producing the bright blue color that indicated a state of relaxation so deep it bordered on bliss. Chief among these was eating. Whenever I ate, the biodot turned its most radiant blue. Clearly, eating was an activity with profound emotional and spiritual reverberations, and just as clearly, it was an activity that resided at the opposite end of the emotional spectrum from stress. Suddenly, it seemed pretty obvious why eating often becomes something other than the simple act of satisfying our physical hunger. Eating is a fast palliative for the stress that overwhelms us, a surrogate for the emotional and spiritual nourishment we need and never receive, a way of feeling our physicality in a world that all too rarely permits us to do so. In short, the act of eating is a gateway to some of our deepest feelings. This is why, if we just make a simple resolve to only eat in truth during the month of Elul, to eat only when we are truly hungry, only all that your soul desires, I think we'll be amazed how much of the truth of our lives we'll dredge up. What a complex of repressed feeling and dysfunction this simple focus will bring floating up to the forefront of our consciousness. The same thing would happen if we made a similar resolve regarding sexual activity, which is, if anything, even more emotionally charged. A congregant came to me recently to tell me of his experience in doing precisely this. One day, he had realized that he had never been honest about the most intimate aspects of his marital relationship. Physically and emotionally, he had been hiding who he really was, pretending to be always eager for sex when the truth was that sometimes he was and sometimes he wasn't, ignoring the waves of ambiguity he often felt in the midst of sex for fear of hurting his wife, fending off the deepest sort of intimacy for fear of revealing himself to another human being. Suddenly conscious of all this, he had resolved to live this part of his life as truthfully as he possibly could, to stop pretending, to stop ignoring, to stop fending off, and this single resolve had begun to transform not only his marriage, but the rest of his life as well. Sometimes his new candor did, in fact, hurt his wife's feelings, but they always managed to get over it, to talk it out, and they felt so much closer now that they couldn't imagine how they had managed to live at such a distance from each other before. And this man now found himself unwilling to hide himself at work either. And this had changed his entire relationship to his job. realizing that he could really be himself at work, had removed the single greatest source of stress there, and he now found himself enjoying his work in a way he never had before. Money, like food and sex, can be another fruitful object of mindful focus. I recently enrolled in a computerized banking service. Every day, the computer shows me a complete breakdown of every financial transaction I make, every penny I spend. I find that I am no longer able to entertain fantasies about how I spend money. The computer rubs my nose in the truth every day. Every day, I have to face the reality of my neurotic compulsions and dependencies. Every day, I have to look at a very precise record of what is really important to me, what my priorities really are. A very different matter, in most cases, from what I imagine them to be. The truth of our lives is reflected in everything we do, and if we focus on even one small part of our lives, it brings up the entire truth of it. So we can pray, we can meditate, and we can set aside a moment every day for reflection, or we can simply choose one thing in our life and live that one small aspect in truth, and then watch in amazement as the larger truth of our life begins to emerge. The truth is, every moment of our life carries with it the possibility of a great blessing and a great curse. A blessing if we live in truth, a curse if we do not. This is the time of year we are bidden to know the truth. In fact, we are commanded to do so. Re'eh. Look, pay attention. For I have put before you a great blessing and a considerable curse right there in the moment before you. All that's required of you is to see what's in front of your face and to choose the blessing in it. Parshat Shoftim. I once went for a hike with my son Stephen, who is an entomologist in a nature preserve on Martha's Vineyard. A storm came up and we had to take refuge in a little shack with a big picture window. I sat looking out the window in the rain at the birds and other flora and fauna of Martha's Vineyard, none of which was all that compelling. My son, on the other hand, was having a much more interesting time. He was looking not through the window at what was outside, but rather at the window itself. The window, he soon pointed out to me, was a very active world in and of itself, a nature preserve for insect life, as it were. And in fact, when I gave my full attention to the window instead of just looking through it, it turned out to be a veritable wonderland, full of gossamer membranes, spherical silver eggs, and metallic silver flies, like Art Deco flying machines. It was clear this window wasn't just something through which to view the world, it was a world in itself, a place with a life of its own. Parshat Shoftim, which we read during the first or second week of the month of Elul, begins with what seems like a simple prescription for the establishment of a judicial system. Judges and officers you shall appoint for yourselves in all your gates. But the great Hasidic Torah commentary, the Iturei Torah, read this passage as an imperative of a very different sort, an imperative for a kind of inner mindfulness. According to the Iturei Torah, there are seven gates, seven windows to the soul, the two eyes, the two ears, the two nostrils, and the mouth. Everything that passes into our consciousness must enter through one of these gates. So, at the deepest level, the passage cited above has nothing to do with establishment of a system of judges and courts, but deals rather with being mindful of the process of consciousness itself. The essential act of the high holiday season is teshuvah, a turning toward mindfulness, and an important step in this process is a kind of turning in to examine our perceptive mechanisms, the way we see the world. It is a shifting of our gaze from the world itself to the window through which we see it, because that window, the screen of our consciousness, is not just a blank, transparent medium, rather, it is a world unto itself. A world teeming with life, and that life affects what we see. And because that life makes us see the world differently, the first step in teshuvah is to look at the window itself. When the shofar blows on the first day of Elul and every morning thereafter, it reminds us to turn our gaze inward and to place judgment at the gates of our consciousness, to shift our focus from the outside world to the considerable activity taking place in the window through which we view it. There are several very powerful suggestions later on in the Parshat Shoftim as to precisely what it is we should be looking for during the month of Elul as we turn toward the gates of the soul in preparation for Teshuvah. These suggestions come, oddly enough, in the laws of war that are enunciated toward the end of the Parsha. Before Israel goes off to war, the Torah tells us, the officers of the army must address the people and tell them the following. Who is the man who has built a new house but has not yet inhabited it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the war, and another man inhabit his house. Who is the man who has planted a vineyard and has not yet harvested it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the war, and another man harvest it. Who is the man who has been betrothed to a woman but has yet not taken her to wife? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the war and another man take her. The idea of all this seems to be that if we leave something incomplete, we fall into the state of mind the rabbis call trefa da'at, a torn mind, a mind pulled in various directions. A person in such a state of mind would be of little use in an army. He would be unable to focus on the task at hand and might even present a danger to his fellow soldiers. During a brief stint as a prison chaplain, I once spoke to a gang member who described what it was like to go to war with his fellow gang members. He spoke glowingly of the sense of total trust you had to have in the person in front of you and the person behind you. Your very life hung on their doing what they were supposed to do. But if they were in a state of trefa da'at, if there was unfinished business pulling their awareness away from the present moment, they wouldn't be trustworthy. In fact, they would pose a real threat to your survival. We see this very clearly around death. The threefold repetition of the phrase, lest he die, is not insignificant. In my work as a hospice chaplain, I often witnessed the irresistible urge people have to tie up loose ends as death approaches, to leave their checkbook balanced, to make their funeral arrangements, to finally confess to something that has been on their conscience, to make reconciliation with a friend or a loved one. The urge to complete unfinished business, to tie up loose ends, is one of the strongest forces in nature, and God help anyone who stands in its way. In my experience, this is the single most common source of family conflict around death. The person who is dying asks his family to help him balance his checkbook, or purchase a plot in a cemetery. But the members of the family still alive, healthy, and very much caught up in the full-time occupation of denying death, don't want to listen. What are you talking about? They tell him. You're not going to die. A response that provokes unbearable frustration and alienation in the dying, who desperately need to do these things. When this need is ignored, they feel more than ever that they are facing death alone. But, like everything else about death, this urge is only an intensification of what happens throughout life. Death is merely a time when what is usually unconscious and invisible becomes conscious and visible. So, while we are conducting spiritual inventory during Elul, we might begin by asking ourselves, what are the loose ends in my life? How is my mind torn? Where are the places my mind keeps wanting to go? What is the unfinished business in my life? What have I left undone? When we look out at the world through a torn mind, our experience of the world is torn. In some cases, we might decide that it's just time to let go, to recognize that we are distracted by something that will never be completed. And in some cases, we might decide that the only cure is in fact completion, that there's nothing for it but to tie up that loose end. No way to keep our energy and focus from constantly draining away from the present tense reality of our actual experience, except to finish that which remains unfinished. Life is impossibly complex. We are all like jugglers with too many balls in the air by far. Taking a clear look at our lives, we might simply decide that we can't possibly complete all the unfinished business we've set in motion. Finally coming home at 9 or 10 at night from a day at work that began at 6 a.m., our mind torn to shreds by the thought of all the phone calls we never had time to return and the tasks we couldn't complete, we might sense, in a moment of quiet, how much pain all of this has left us in. So, when we are taking inventory, one of the things we might decide is that we have to simplify our lives. We have to do fewer things. We have to go to our bosses, or we have to tell ourselves, look, there is just too much on my plate. I'm trefa da'at. I'm unfocused. I'm torn. The energy of that undedicated house, that unharvested vineyard, that unconsummated marriage, all that energy is tearing my mind, pulling my focus in 100 directions and leaving me not much good for anything. And worst of all, it is causing me to look out at the world through a shattered window. Perhaps that's why the world seems so torn to me. I think this might be a very important thing to look at during Elul, while we are examining the glass in front of our face, the window to the soul. But there was another instruction officers were required to give their troops toward the end of Parshat Shoftim, and this instruction also points us to something we might be looking at during this month of Elul, as we turn toward the gates of the soul in preparation for Teshuvah. Who is the man who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return to his house, lest his brother's heart melt, as his heart has. The assumption beneath this admonition is staggering in both its scope and its simplicity. We all share the same heart. We penetrate each other far more than we are ordinarily aware. Ordinarily, we are taken in by the materialist myth of discrete being. We look like we are separate bodies. We look like we are discrete from one another. Physically, we can see where one of us begins and another of us ends, but emotionally, spiritually, it simply isn't this way. Our feelings and our spiritual impulses flow freely beyond the boundaries of the self. And this is something that each of us knows intuitively for a certainty. We know, for example, that when we go to visit a friend and they are depressed and we talk to them for a while, when we leave them, they will feel better, but we will feel worse. Or, if we're at a football game, we will feel the excitement of the crowd in our own person, passing through us, penetrating our discrete physical boundaries, ignoring these boundaries completely. We know that emotions are contagious. We know they do not honor the boundaries of self, and even seem to mock them. We all have the same heart. So if someone is afraid, the Torah tells us, we had better send him home from battle before the fear spreads from his heart to ours. The fear is more real than the self. But this emotional contagion is not limited to fear. Fear is only one example of what ripples soul to soul and heart to heart. Love also does this. So does happiness. So does suffering. Parshat Netzavim, another of the Torah portions we read during the month of Elul, contains some very good advice about how to accomplish this business of spiritual accounting. Where is this thing called Teshuvah located, the Torah asks. Well, it isn't in heaven, so please don't say I can't do this thing because I don't know how to get to heaven. And it isn't across the sea, so please don't say I can't do this thing because I don't have a steamship ticket. Rather, it is exceedingly near to you, in your mouth and in your heart, so you can do it. Don't look off in the distance, and don't look outside yourself either, the Torah is telling us. Look at your own heart. Don't look out the window. Look at the window itself. What is the pain that is pressing on your heart right this moment? That's what you need to make teshuvah about. You need to make teshuvah about your fractured mind and your fearful heart. What is occluding the deep connection between you and your fellow human beings? That is also right there over your heart, and that also needs to be looked at. One of the things that most often impedes this connection is our fear of one another's pain. We have already established that we all have one heart. Deep down, we know this very well, but what we are usually not aware of is how much we feel other people's pain and how much energy we waste trying to defend ourselves against it. Recently, I was counseling two close friends. They were having a fight, and I was pretty well caught in the middle of it. One of these people was suffering terribly from loneliness, and because of this, he had made impossible demands on his friend. The second fellow was overburdened by work and overstressed by family problems to begin with, and so became very angry at his friend for the demands he was making. And there I was in the middle, feeling the first guy's loneliness intensely and the second guy's stress and frustration just as strongly. But instead of feeling empathy for them, I found that I was getting angry at both of them. Suddenly, I felt very critical feelings toward them. Why? Because I felt I was responsible for them and their pain. I felt I had to do something about it, and because I knew there was nothing I could do, because I knew I was powerless to make their pain go away, I was doing the next best thing. I was trying to keep it at arm's length, to defend myself against it. Of course, that was impossible. We can't help feeling each other's pain. We all share the same heart. If someone else is suffering, there's no way we can shut it out. It spreads heart to heart and soul to soul, a movement that is absolutely irresistible, like the waters of a flood. And I started to wonder, how many people am I angry at? How many people do I harbor ungenerous feelings toward simply because I am privy to their suffering and frightened by it, and so need to keep it at bay with anger and criticism? But the problem is never the suffering. The problem is our feeling that we have to do something about it. I often visit people in hospitals, and over the years I've gotten into the habit of doing a special meditation at the threshold of each hospital room. I stand in the threshold, breathing deeply until I can feel the fear that always follows me into these rooms. It is the fear of not being able to do anything to help the person who is ill. What, after all, can I do? Can I make their illness go away? If they are dying, can I forestall their death? Perhaps I can comfort them, but what if I say the wrong thing and make things even worse? So I stand in the doorway until I feel this fear come up, as it always does, until it has filled me completely, and then I remind myself that I am not going into that room to do anything for the person who is ill. Rather, I am going there to be with them, to listen to them, to offer them the only gift that makes any difference at all in this transaction, the gift of my presence. And when this meditation works, and I really am able to simply be with them and let their feelings flow naturally from their heart to mine, it is almost always a beautiful experience, a rich experience for me, whatever effect it may have on them. And it's quite clear that there is nothing to fear from their suffering when it flows from their heart to my heart. Suffering is just suffering, a feeling that only wants release from the imprisonment of the self, a spiritual impulse that often ennobles, and that, like any feeling, carries its own considerable burden of beauty with it. And this is even true of fear and of anger, and of every other feeling that spreads heart to heart until it has filled the world. It is true of love, and it is true of compassion. So even if we're not going off to war, these ancient laws of war are still extremely useful, especially during the month of Elul. As we stand watch at the gate of our soul, as we turn our attention from what is outside the window to the window itself. What unfinished business, what unnecessary complexity is making us trefa da'at, is tearing our focus away from the present tense reality of our experience, from the present moment, the only place where we can really have our lives. And what shadow of fear or anger, what imagined impotence is keeping us from a deep emotional and spiritual connection to the people around us? Is the world really torn and dark? Or does it just appear that way to us because we are taking it in through a torn mind and a hardened heart? Judges, you shall put in all your gates. This is how Teshuvah begins. When Elul comes around again, watch the window. Keep a mindful eye on the gates of the soul. Parshat Ki Tetzeh. Oddly enough, Parshat Ki Tetzeh, which we read during the third week of Elul, also derives a lesson in the kind of mindfulness we are trying to cultivate during this month from the laws of war. Images of war abound during Elul. On the first day of Elul, we begin to add the 27th psalm to our morning and evening prayers. Though armies are arrayed against me, I will have no fear. Though war threatens, I will remain steadfast in my faith, reads the 27th Psalm. It is as if the tradition is trying to tell us, this business of becoming aware of ourselves is a matter of life and death. This business of finding out who we really are needs to be approached with the focus and energy of a military campaign. In any case, whereas Parshat Shoftim derives its lessons about mindful awareness from the moment just before battle, Ki Tetzeh focuses on the moment just afterward. When you have been victorious in battle, this parsha begins, and you are carrying away your captives, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman with a good figure, and you feel desire for her, and you want to take her to yourself to be your wife, first, you must bring her into your house, and have her shave her head, and cut off her fingernails, and remove the dress she was wearing when you captured her. She must remain in your house weeping for her father and her mother for a full month, and after that, you may come to her and be her husband. This passage deals with a rather ugly human impulse that is as ancient as the hills and as current as the day before yesterday. Men, victorious in war, raging testosterone unleashed by battle and now utterly unrestrained, grab and rape the first women they see on the streets of the cities they have just vanquished. Ancient art and literature and yesterday's newspapers are full of this disturbing human tendency. Greek and Shakespearean tragedy, the rape of the Sabine women, the Serbo-Croatian wars. Desire run amok has always been and continues to be one of the most troublesome of human impulses. Nor are the implements for arousing desire any less universal or current. Elul always falls in the late summer, and I do weddings almost every Sunday then. Standing under the chuppah with bride and groom on the week we read Parshat Ki Tetzeh, I am often reminded that carefully done fingernails, well-coiffed hair, and alluring dresses are still frequently employed to arouse a passion in a man sufficient to get him under the wedding canopy. The Torah is not really concerned with the specific case of the woman captured in battle. I think it has a larger principle in mind in all this. It seems to be suggesting a method for dealing with the tyranny of passion and desire in our lives in general. The raging lust of the victorious soldier is merely one instance, one example of that desire for which we humans throw away our lives, the living death we bring upon ourselves. The poet John Keats maps out this territory very well in his poem, La Belle Dame sans Merci. She took me to her elfin grot, and there she wept and sighed full sore, and there I shut her wild, wild eyes with kisses four. And there she lulled me asleep, and there I dreamed, ah, woe betide, the latest dream I ever dreamed. On the cold hill's side. I saw pale kings and princes too, pale warriors, death pale were they all. They cried, La belle dame sans merci hath thee in thrall. I saw their starved lips in the gloam, with horrid warning gaped wide. And I awoke and found me here, on the cold hill's side. And this is why I sojourn here, alone and palely loitering, though the sedge is withered from the lake, and no birds sing. The kind of impulse Keats describes arises in our lives in many forms. It shows itself in the impulse that might seduce us into a ruinous midlife affair, or that might cause us to sacrifice our families for ambition, or to give up our heart's work for the pursuit of material excess, or to give up our integrity for fame and fortune, or God for the pursuit of pleasure. Given how pernicious and pervasive such impulses are, how much damage they could do to us, we might find ourselves asking this, why doesn't the Torah just do away with them altogether? Why doesn't the Torah just tell us not to take the woman captive in the first place? I think there might be several ways of answering this question. First off, it would have been unrealistic for the Torah to have done so, and the Torah is above all an extremely realistic work. The Torah never permits too much distance between the values it proposes and the way people actually behave, because it recognizes that to do so would break the connection between our lives and the Torah, between our lives and the will of God. So, the Torah can't afford to do too much violence to the way we are, and this lustful impulse, unfortunately, has been repeated throughout human history. But trying to efface the impulse altogether might not only have been unrealistic, it might have been undesirable. Like everything we have been given in this life, this impulse might also have its place, its use. This impulse, in fact, might be part and parcel of the process of human creativity. This, at least, is the suggestion of a story that is told in the Talmud in Masechet Yoma. The children of Israel, it seems, once prayed to God that the impulse that tempted them into sexual misconduct be handed over to them as a captive. After they fasted for 3 days and three nights, this tempter was in fact handed over to them. The prophet warned them that if they killed it, they would bring the world down with it, so they imprisoned it for 3 days instead. But there wasn't a fresh egg to be found in the entire land of Israel for those 3 days. Finally, they just put out its eyes and let it loose again. The Talmud seems to be saying that this business of desire is the basis of our creativity, our productivity. Our desire for the apple in the Garden of Eden got us kicked out of Eden, but it also propelled us into history, and if we try to squelch it or bury it, we might stop being productive. History might grind to a halt. Since we can't and probably shouldn't repress our desires, and since it is so often a calamity when we follow them, what should we do? The passage from the Parshat Ki Tetzeh points us to an answer. First of all, we watch our desires arise. The soldier at the beginning of the Parshat Ki Tetzeh has to live with his desire, to watch it as it evolves without acting on it for a full month. And the second thing we can learn from him is that once we have our desires firmly in view, we can then strip them of their exotic dress. We can make them cut off their fingernails and their hair. We can make them take off that revealing frock they were wearing when we first saw them. In other words, we can see them for what they really are. In his autobiography of his early teenage years, The Basketball Diaries, the poet Jim Carroll writes about a moment when he saw his own displaced passion stripped of its exotic disguise. Already a notorious womanizer, Carroll found himself on a long, slow elevator one day with a beautiful woman for whom he felt an immediate sexual longing. He wanted to make a move right away, but there were other people on the elevator, so acting on this longing was not an option. But as the elevator made its seemingly endless ascent, he began to realize that in truth, he had no desire to make love to this woman at all. That impulse he was feeling was a dozen other things. It was the need to have his very weak ego affirmed by still another conquest. It was the need to cover up the bottomless pit of emptiness he felt at the core of his being with a rush of strong sensation. With this impulse now stripped bare of its exotic dress, Carroll understood not only that he didn't have to act on it, but that, moreover, he didn't even want to. Why do we run after ambition? Why do we need fame and fortune? Why do we need to have a sexual conquest? If we try to push these desires down, they'll only come up somewhere else. If we kill them off altogether, we may be doing violence to ourselves. We may be killing off the basis of our real creativity. Better to simply strip these desires of their romance and then watch them for a month before acting on them, before taking them to yourself. And what better time to do this than the month of Elul, the month we are supposed to devote to the regular cultivation of self-awareness, the month in which we begin the process of teshuvah by shifting our gaze from the world outside to the consciousness through which we view that world. Certainly, desire is a significant component of that consciousness, perhaps the most significant component. So this is something else we can do during the month of Elul. We can devote a bit of time each day to locating our own particular belle dame sans merci, to identifying whatever desire has distorted our lives, the beautiful delusion for which we've thrown everything away, or for which we stand ready to do so in any case. And when we've located it, all we have to do is look at it. We don't have to kill it, and we certainly don't have to act on it either. We can just let it arise in the fullness of its being, unromantically stripped down to the naked impulse that it is, without the finery of romance, without hair, nails, or dress, just the bare impulse itself. We can watch this impulse as it arises for the entire month of Elul, and if after a month it still seems to be something that we want, something that continues to arouse strong feeling in us, then we've learned something useful about ourselves. But if this desire, stripped of its romantic trappings, simply fades away, then we've learned something even more useful. We've learned that there is more to heaven and earth than those things on the surface of the world that provoke desire in our hearts. We've learned that if we always act on our desires, on those unmitigated impulses that constantly rise up in our hearts and our minds, then we are doomed to a living death, doomed to be always palely loitering after a lock of hair and a bit of nail and cloth, the ghostly phantoms of desire. Wait on God. Be strong and courageous of heart and wait on God. This is the very good advice of that same 27th psalm we recite twice each day during the month of Elul. Better to wait on God, better to just watch our impulses arise, and wait for truth, wait for something deeper. Better to be strong and brave of heart than to surrender our lives to the empty stuff of desire and to spend the rest of our lives palely loitering on a cold hillside where no birds sing. Chapter 5. This is real, and you are completely unprepared. Slichot. A mindful awareness of our circumstances often makes things seem worse and not better. This is an illusion, of course, but it doesn't feel like one, especially when we are in the first throes of discovery. Suddenly aware of problems we never knew we had, we may genuinely feel that we are much worse off than we thought we were. We may feel a sense of urgency, even of desperation, about our plight. This urgent, desperate sense is the emotional basis of Slichot, the week of urgent, desperate prayer that commences approximately 3 weeks into the process of daily contemplation we began with the blowing of the shofar on the first day of Elul. Traditionally, Slichot begins with a midnight prayer service on the Saturday night before Rosh Hashanah, or on the previous Saturday night if there are fewer than 4 days between that Saturday and Rosh Hashanah, and continues with special prayers of supplication recited by the pious at dawn each day of the following week. But even if we are not so pious, even if we don't attend the Slichot service on Saturday night that serves as a kind of grand overture to the high holiday season, we may still feel a sense of urgency, a sense of desperation, as Rosh Hashanah approaches. This is particularly true if we have been paying attention to the larger process, if we began on Tisha B'Av by allowing ourselves to be reminded of the ways we have become alienated from ourselves and from God, if we heard the shofar blow on the first day of Elul and began a month of contemplation and taking account of our souls. After all, in less than 1 week, we will stand before God. If we are tuned into this reality, we can't help but feel urgent and desperate now. The ritual of Slichot is first mentioned in an obscure compilation of medieval midrash, the Tana Devet Eliyahu Zuta. David knew that the temple would be destroyed in the future, and the sacrificial cult would be nullified, and David was troubled, thinking, how will Israel make atonement then? So God said to David, when troubles come upon Israel, let them, 1, stand before me together as a single unit, 2, and make confession before me, 3, and say the Slichot, forgiveness service, before me, and I will answer them. But how did God reveal these services to Israel? God came down from the heavenly mist like a shiliach tzibur, a cantor, wrapped in a talit, and revealed to Moses the order of the service of forgiveness. There are many things about this rabbinic legend that strike a deep chord, but the first arresting image is the one of all Israel standing before God, Ba'agudach Achat, as a single spiritual unit. I always feel that sense acutely during the high holiday season, and especially on the first night of Rosh Hashanah, when we gather in great numbers for the first time. I'll never forget my first year in San Francisco when I saw this for the first time. I had come from